Hey everyone, it's Carlene, and welcome back to episode 18. Yeah, 18 of The Sexual Philosopher. This particular episode is with Mark, and just a quick little thing. We had to break this down into two episodes just because Mark and I really got into some pretty intense discussions about both affairs and bodies. The discussion of fidelity comes up. And in passing, domestic abuse comes up, so I just want to do a little content warning as well. And then we go into a pretty significant discussion about bodies and functions and yeah, et cetera on that. I'm not very articulate today, so that will just be what it is. But yeah, so anyway, it's a two-part series with Mark. And so next week we'll be wrapping it up. So I hope you enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Sexual Philosopher. This is Carlene and today I am here with Mark.
Hello, hi. Mark.
Mark and I, how did we meet exactly? We met through, her pseudonym was Natalie on the podcast, I think, right?
Yep.
Because you're neighbors. Okay.
Yeah, we were at her birthday party.
Oh, that's right.
And we got to talking.
That's right. We were talking about Sweden and Denmark. Yeah.
both me and my partner were learning Swedish at the time.
Yeah.
You are fluent in Danish?
In Danish, yes. Yeah. Correct. Not fluent anymore, unfortunately. It's been like over a decade, but I can speak somewhat conversational Danish after 10 years of disuse. The first question is, go ahead and summarize your upbringing.
Well, I grew up in the beloved Gresham, Oregon, which is about 10 miles east of here. I would say I had a fairly solid, like, middle-class family. My parents declared bankruptcy when I think I was like 8. It's kind of fuzzy around that period of time. But outside of that, like, you know, they kind of got their shit together and figured out their finances. And I would say that I grew up fairly economically comfortable.
Okay.
Not like extravagant, but, you know, I rarely in my childhood did we ever find that we were wanting.
Okay.
My parents, for as much as I can remember, for the first several years of my life, had a good relationship, a loving relationship. They had a loving relationship with their children. And then around 8 years old, my dad had an affair with my mom's twin sister. And that kind of shook the foundations of everything and kind of really developed who me and my brother became as adult human beings. My mom became very distant. She is an alcoholic and a narcissist and all those wonderful.
Was she an alcoholic through most of your life?
She was an alcoholic to you, I'm guessing. Most of my life. I didn't realize it. I didn't recognize it until much later in life.
Yeah.
But like it occurred to me, like she would wake up and pour herself like Carlo Rossi Burgundy was like her go-to with like some 7-Up or Sprite or something in it.
Oh, interesting.
And so like, you know, she would, if we were leaving the house, she would fill up like a little suck jug and like drive around getting blitzed Had no idea as a kid. Like, no idea. Like, oh, yeah, my mom is totally an alcoholic. And so their relationship was really strained, her and my dad's. And they decided to stick it out for the kids. And that was probably the worst decision that they could have made. Both me and my brother are also adopted. So that, I was actually talking with my partner this morning about some of that. And that definitely creates an interesting dynamic for my emotional psyche, just because, you know, I have this set of people who gave me up at a very young age, basically right after I was born, into this family that did not have great tools and really should not have been parents. And so as their relationship was really just weird, really strained, I had the bedroom next to the master bedroom, so their bedroom. So sometimes, very rarely, but sometimes I would hear them having sex next door. And I knew what they were doing, even at that age. Like, I knew what was going on. I didn't really know, like, you know, what sex was, but I definitely, like, knew the business that was going on next door.
Absolutely.
I remember me and my brother, it was right before Christmas, or maybe it was Christmas, we were staying up late to catch Santa. And we walk out. So our house was set up. We had a living room, and then off of the living room through a doorway was our family room. And so we like walk into the living room and kind of peek through the doorway into the family room, and my mom and dad are having sex on the couch in there. And I would say we were probably, I was probably six, so like maybe kindergarten, maybe first grade, maybe. And I, part of me like kind of knew what was happening, but part of me was like kind of confused. And my brother, who's older, he's about, just about 2 years older than me, he was like, we need to go.
How'd you grow up religion-wise?
Religion was not really a thing in our house. Neither of my parents are religious. They're not anti-religious. I think that they would both consider themselves Christian, but only in like very tenuous sense of like, well, if I'm supposed to be something, that's what I would be. Not that they follow any tenets of Christianity or anything. But we had, very young, there was a church down the street. I recall we went to like Sunday school or something like that. I you know, have some recollection of being very young in this, like, you know, young Christian thing. Me and my brother. But outside of that, it was never really pressured. There was no expectation around religion. In fact, my parents were kind of awesome about that. It was really kind of left up to me and my brother how we wanted to pursue that, which ultimately, after kind of looking at things through my adolescence, I became a staunch atheist, essentially. I don't need God to tell me how to be a human being. Yeah. So that's kind of what religion was like in my family.
Yeah. So it wasn't a huge influence on your sexuality, for sure.
No, definitely not.
How did you learn about sex? I mean, it sounds like you learned about it a little bit by
seeing and hearing
it. It's pretty common.
You grow up in a household, and like, it happens, you know?
I walked into my parents so often. I think, did I mention it in a podcast? I can't remember, but like in my house, there was so little privacy, like totally by, well, I mean, yeah, I mean, it wasn't like forced. I mean, my parents didn't ever snoop or anything. They were very respectful of privacy, but we like moved in and out of each other's rooms, and like we just were all up in each other's business. We really liked each other, which was great. So my parents always left their bedroom door open, and there was one night I needed lip balm, Carmex specifically. And like I didn't have any in my bedroom, and my lips were so dry, and like I couldn't fall asleep, and I was really bugged by it. I was like 8. And I just wandered into their bedroom and was like, I shouldn't be witnessing this. Like, this is their private time, and I'm going to totally fuck it up. So I just kind of quietly, like, backed out. I was like, oops, sorry about that. So, yeah, that's a pretty common way to, especially if you're, I mean, I've had guests on who, like, their parents have very sexless relationships, and that's not the way they learn. But, you know, if you live in a small space and there are parents that are having sex,
yeah,
the likelihood of you walking in on them is like pretty much 100%.
And I would say that, you know, after that kind of critical point, my parents pretty much had a pretty sexless relationship.
Like, yeah,
it would happen on rare occasion. They were open about talking about it. They didn't go into detail, but, you know, they there was one thing that I did appreciate about my family dynamic is that my parents were fairly open. There wasn't a whole lot that was hidden, and I really kind of appreciate that, you know. It set me up for being a much more open-minded and just overall open person. I'm not as open as I'd like to be, but I think I'm, you know, farther ahead of some other folks in terms of that regard. My first actual experience with sex, like knowing what it was, what was going on, I think I was like maybe 9. My brother and his good friend came over. His friend was staying the night with us, and he brought one of his dad's porn tapes with him. And so it was late at night. Both the parents had gone to bed and were sitting out in the family room where the TV was, and pop it in the VCR. And I remember it was like this orgy scene. It was like, obviously, like late 80s pornography. So yeah, it's like super cheesy. The music's going. But it's like, it's also kind of beautiful because it's like this big open room that's like all white, and there's like these, you know, different levels, and like there are just people fucking everywhere, and mm-hmm. like the camera's getting up on this, you know, chick that's getting pounded while she's fucking sucking some guy off, and I was like enamored by it.
Yeah,
I was like, and both my brother and his friend were like, ew, that's gross, and they're like, and I was just like, wow, hypnotized.
Yeah. I miss older porn a lot. On so many levels. Oh, mm-hmm. I could get into the discussion of pornography.
I'm sure
a
we
lot,
could talk
but
all day about it.
But I totally know what you're talking about. There's actually a place in Denver that and it's so wonderful. It's actually like, it's basically a sex hotel. That is what it's there for. It's not a swingers club. It's called Mon Chalet, if anybody wants to go there. My partner and I went there with a couple, and there's this pool. So, like, you have your room, and there's, like, a swing that's in the closet you can pull out and, like, hang over the bed. And that was, like, I was like, this is really intense. And they have this, like, crazy sex chair that is actually kind of painful because it's not padded anywhere. So that sucked. And this huge bathtub that, like, all four of us could comfortably sit in. And
that
my partner,
amazing.
It was really awesome, yeah. And my partner's a photographer, so, like, he actually was, like, taking pictures of it. There's some fucking beautiful pictures that he's taken of, like, us in the bathtub, the three of us. But then there's this pool that you can walk to, and it's an indoor pool, and they've got all these, like, lounge chairs and area, like some really, like queen-size, basically, kind of, like, beach lounge chairs, or, like, lounge chairs. But there's... And then there's the pool, and there's pornography playing, and it's all old pornography, and it made me feel so much better because I was like, well, they're probably not going to spring for the type of porn that I would watch, like current porn, which would be like really, really ethical and just much more sexy porn than what you see.
Right,
but
a lot more sensual,
yeah,
and like emotional than just,
yeah,
like, I'm going to skull fuck this chick, right?
Totally. Yeah. And yeah, and I've just like, I know, so I read the book, The Empire of Illusion, which it's by Chris Hedges. I highly recommend people read it. And he has this whole chapter on, it's called The Illusion of Love, but it's about the modern pornography industry and discussing like gonzo porn and how fucked up it is. And to full disclosure, Chris Hedges is a former, he was in seminary school. I can't remember what his religion is, but he definitely, like, you can see that bias a little bit. But he's a fantastic journalist as well. And, like, he discusses the incredible, I mean, so many of these women who, you know, act in gonzo porn, they're so abused. There's a lot of non-consensual stuff that goes on against them. There, because of that, there's a lot of drug use and the testing standard. Like, it was really fascinating, and I don't pretend to be the expert on all of this, but it made me very aware of the fact that I need to be very careful about the pornography that I consume.
Right.
So anyway, but what I like about older pornography is there, you know, instead of the gonzo porn, which like cuts out the plot and goes straight to, you know, the like fucking her and all of her holes. There's a plot line in these 80s films and 90s films, and it's, I don't know, like it feels a little bit more like real sex.
In some ways,
like.
Yeah. Yeah. In some ways,
I mean, it's like a little over the top, of course. But absolutely. I also like that, you know, like.
But it's, there is, even if it's fake, there is a level of connection that is happening between the people who are having sex on screen.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I feel like with current porn, it's just, let's see how extreme we can fuck this chick.
Mm-hmm.
And use
yes.
her. Women in porn are purely objective. They're not a participant. They mm-hmm. are purely there to receive a cock in some way.
Yeah.
And that really doesn't appeal to me. Like, lesbian porn is kind of my go-to
mm-hmm.
because it often, not always, but it often removes that aspect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is that level, even again, even if it is fake, that level of perceived intimacy that just doesn't come with the standard heterosex nowadays. And even gay porn, like I'm not a fan of gay porn for that reason, because
yeah.
it's also moved in that direction, and I'm not about using your cock as a weapon.
Yeah I will say there are a lot of really good porn outlets out there. I've mentioned it before here, Four Chambers. It used to be called a four-chambered heart, I think, but now it's called Four Chambers. They make some of the hottest porn, like, oh my God. And they do like a Patreon situation, so it's not like, it's a subscription. I don't know. I'm figuring it out. I wanted to get it for my partner for Christmas in addition to what I got him. And this will be airing after Christmas, okay. So.
So no spoilers.
But Mark is a massage therapist. I can say that, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And I got John the, I got him. He needs a damn massage really bad. So, but anyway, there's queer porn TV, which I don't like the settings as much. Oh man, like, I think I need to have a viewing, if people are down for it, of some Four Chambers at the house, like projected on the wall. It's like, because that's how I first watched it at my surrogate partner therapy training.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, so, it's so erotic. Like they soften everything kind of, there's beautiful colors in the background. They kind of soften the background. And it's just like queer porn TV was a little more, like, it was pretty obvious that it was on a set, and you were kind of like, oh, okay, like, but it was very nice.
Mm-hmm.
But that's another one. But yeah, there's some really great outlets out there. Porn itself is not inherently wrong. I appreciate its existence. I'm glad it exists, but it obviously exists within the construct of a, like, hegemonic, patriarchal, white, supremacist, transphobic society.
And it's portrayed in that way.
Yeah, and I think it amplifies that, because it's like, we already have issues with sex, right? And so, like, this is an industry that's very much kind of demonized, and they're just like, fuck it. You know what I mean? And so you see this amplification of the problems that we see in society. You know what I mean? Like, where, like, oh man, I wanted to watch some trans porn one time, and I was like, this was a big mistake. But also, go to Four Chambered Heart, because I've watched trans porn there and it's fantastic.
So there was a website that I found recently that it was kind of a burgeoning site, so there wasn't a whole lot of content on there, and I think they only had like four models or something like that, but it was just that, it was porn run by trans people.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't this, I don't know if you guys have ever watched trans porn, but it's often just disgusting.
Oh, it's so demeaning. It's terrible. It's, I can't do it.
Yeah. It's like,
and we're talking mainstream porn.
Yes.
Mainstream trans porn, just to clarify.
But it was lovely. Like, mm-hmm. it was very erotic. It was very stimulating. It was very respectful. I mean, there can be a level of disrespect in a sexual relationship mm-hmm. as long as it's consensual and as long as it's yes. been announced to everyone and everybody is okay with that. It can be really hot, mm-hmm. but...
Well, humiliation play is a thing. People...
Absolutely.
Engage in humiliation play.
But when, you know, when the mainstream of porn is that, I feel like it sends a signal, especially to younger people who are discovering sex through porn, mm-hmm. that this is how sex is. And that's absolutely not how sex is. That's not how sex should work. And I was actually having a conversation with a colleague recently about this, is that for a lot of people, we live in a society that, first of all, doesn't like to talk about sex. We live in a Puritan society. Mm-hmm. Whether we want to admit that or not, that's where we come from. And that's very much, you know, when you look at government and what's happening in politics, like, that's very much where this mindset is coming from. And so we live in a society that's very hushed about it to begin with. And then on top of it, like, the only outlets that people are really finding for this information is the internet. And the internet mm-hmm. is a terrible teacher, let me tell you that. And so, you know, when mainstream media is saying, well, this is what sex looks like, you're spitting on them, you're pissing on them, you're slapping them, you're... You know, shoving your... When did a blowjob become a throat fucking?
Yeah.
Like, seriously.
Yeah.
You know, people get the wrong idea of what sex is and what sex can be. And yes, so, it can be those things as yeah. long as everybody involved is happy with that. But that is not the majority of sex.
Yeah. So the book that I'm in the middle of, that I think I've referenced the past couple of episodes, and I'll reference it again, is called Woman on Fire. And one of the things she talks about... So, yes, those can all be aspects of sexuality. But the problem is we're still running into the same issue of, like, okay, so we've just taken the same narrow idea of what sex is and made it really extreme. Mm-hmm. And... So we're in the same position, right?
If not worse,
because there's, like, more objectification. It appears to be a lot less consensual, you know, and appearances do matter, right? Perception right. matters.
Yeah.
There is a wide range. There's an entire buffet of sexual acts that you can do that don't involve... penetration, even, that don't involve getting face fucked, that do involve getting face fucked if that's what you want. And those are very absent in the porn industry,
right?
Which I find to be a bummer, because I want to support them. I've explored a lot about how difficult it is to be in the pornography community, and, like, I want to support that, but I just have major concerns about their personal psychology and worrying about what this does to them if they're constantly objectified or there's non-consensual activities happening on screen for the world to see. Now, pay for your porn. I say it all the time. We all say it. All of the sexologists say it. Pay for your porn. Consume the porn that you really want to see. Ask for it. Don't compromise.
Right.
It's so important. We're kind of off topic of the...
Sorry, yeah.
No. That's totally fine. Yeah. But I wanted to go back a little bit, because you mentioned the affair and that kind of being the crumbling point mm-hmm. for your family. And I just wanted, like... This isn't a plug because I don't know her personally or anything, but there's a new book out called The State of Affairs by Esther Perel, and she is a fantastic psychotherapist in New York City, I believe. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. It's fine. Where she lives doesn't matter much. It's called Rethinking Infidelity, and I'm so glad that this book exists, because... Also, I want people to hear, I mean, you didn't really talk about, like, it sounds like you kind of started to get to maybe a little bit of the root of maybe why that happened, and understanding, like, it sounds like your father, was he carrying your mother through this, and the weight of it was difficult, or?
You know, I honestly really couldn't tell you.
Are you upset with him about it? I guess that's kind of...
I'm upset with both of my parents about it. Not so much the affair, but how they handled things afterwards.
Okay.
I mean, people are going to do what they're going to do. I think it's kind of weird that he had sex with my mom's twin sister.
I don't think it'd be my choice.
No.
I know a lot of people have affairs with siblings, maybe not twins.
Was a lot that was happening in that time frame. I remember this very specifically, that I was 8 years old. Me and my brother, my aunt was living in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. and she was with a very abusive partner out there who isolated her. They lived out in the middle of fucking nowhere in Spooner, Wisconsin. And, you know, he would get drunk and come home and then beat the shit out of her. And we stayed with them, not knowing that this was happening. My aunt had reached out to my parents and, you know, asked if we could come out, mm-hmm. And stay with her and kind of see the world, I guess. Mm-hmm. Which, and it was awesome. We were both really stoked about it. Mm-hmm. And I remember watching, you know, the ball drop and New Year's and everything. So I remember very vividly. It was 1988. And then it came out, and it might have been because of what me and my brother had seen and what we had talked about with my parents. I don't remember any specifics about those conversations, but he had come home and...
Your uncle.
Her partner.
Or her partner.
Yeah, they weren't married.
Okay.
And he had come home, he had been drinking, and he was angry and, like, you know, unleashed hell on her. And they had a loft that was up above kind of the main living area. It was a log cabin. So that happened while we were there. And shortly after we got back, my mom and my grandmother drove out to Wisconsin in a U-Haul, or flew out to Wisconsin and drove her back in a U-Haul, her and her daughter, my cousin, and they stayed with us for a period of time. Mm-hmm. So that is when that happened. So after they got back, they were staying with us. And so there was a lot of trauma, mm-hmm. for her in that period of time. And there, mm-hmm. was a lot of discomfort. And so I think, you know, I don't know. I don't pretend to know what the dynamic was, why it happened, how it happened. That was never really talked about. That was one of those subjects that was just kind of like hush-hush.
Okay, so like it was not discussed.
It happened, we're never going to talk about it again.
Okay.
Right? But I do remember from that point, my mother, me and my brother, I think were sharing a room at the time, or we weren't, but he was like in my room. And I remember my mom coming in and she was bawling. Tears were just rolling down her face. They had been arguing. And she said to us, "I love you, and whatever happens, just I want you to know that I love you." Right? Mm-hmm. And she left. And she was gone for a couple of days. And at the time, I didn't know what was happening. But in retrospect, as I, you know, kind of like piece all these things together, mm-hmm. I recognize what the timeline is and like the things that were happening. And it makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the best thing that could have happened was that she left, they got a divorce, and that was that. Mm-hmm. Because from that point on, life changed completely. I really started struggling with emotional regulation after that. I was constantly getting into fights at school. I was bullied and picked on a lot as a child, and I didn't know how to resolve my emotions around that, and my parents were checked out.
So you didn't have that support.
I didn't have that support. So for several years growing up, you know, things got really hard, and for me, psychologically, emotionally, and at one point I was institutionalized for a period of time. So like intensive psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. And that kind of became a trigger for me of, I need to shut this shit down. Whatever this is, this needs to stop. This needs to just go the fuck away. You know, I didn't have a whole lot of healthy outlets for how to deal with that. And so I just kind of like shoved everything down. Okay. And through my adolescence, again, and especially in my adolescence, that I think is really when my mom's alcoholism took off. The company that she worked for, I don't even remember what the name of the phone company was then. Ma Bell. It was really old. Okay. And then Quest bought them out. When Quest came in and bought them out, she chose to retire. Mm-hmm. So through late middle school and all of high school, My mom just kind of sat around and drank, and then she worked at the elementary school in the cafeteria. She was a lunch lady. Following that, just as kind of an extra income. Mm-hmm. And from that point, she was just kind of regressing further and further, retreating further and further, getting further down her hole, and really kind of lashing out at everyone around her. Like, the smallest thing would just set her off. Mm-hmm. And it really didn't make any fucking sense for anyone.
Yeah. It explains how you had difficulty emotionally regulating, though.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so in high school, like, I talked to you a little bit that I've been dealing with some deep depression. And this is really the time period when that really started to come out. My psychologist kind of identified it earlier on. You know, he's dealing with something, and they talked to my parents about it. But it really started to come out in high school that this was a thing. And I was on lots of antidepressants. I was on all sorts of medications, and it was really bad for mm-hmm. everyone involved. And I really had a big struggle with it, on top of, like, being an adolescent going through fucking puberty and, like, dealing with high school and high school politics and, like, sexuality mm-hmm. and all of those things.
Yeah.
And I knew right away that, like, I was not a straight person. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what I was, but I knew that I was not purely into chicks. And so that development through that period of time was really a struggle. And then my parents, when I was about 19, and I had dealt with a lot of drug abuse and drug use through that time period as well.
Okay.
When I was about 19, I was finally getting clean, or you know, not fucking doing crystal meth and cocaine and all of those wonderful fucking things that I was doing at the time.
Yeah.
Getting my shit together. It came out that my dad had again approached my aunt, and my mom was like, fuck this, I'm done. And it was like, finally, like, there was a celebration. Me and my brother literally fucking celebrated.
Yeah.
We were like, holy shit, it's finally happening. They're getting a fucking divorce.
Yeah.
It sucks that it took them that long. Mm-hmm. Like, now that we're both, you know, I was getting ready to move out. He had moved out. Now that we're both out of the house, they're fucking doing this. But thank God they're finally doing this. Yeah. And, you know, ultimately, our relationships with our parents were trashed from that point.
Yeah.
I had the fortunate opportunity to start to repair that relationship with my father before he passed away. He passed away 2 years ago.
Yeah.
I wish I could have said some of those things to him, like some of my feelings around his relationship and what happened and kind of why me and my brother were where we were in our relationship with them. Mm-hmm. I've completely written off my mother as of about 3 or 4 years ago because she is fucking toxic and crazy. And, like, unreasonable. You cannot reason with that woman.
Is she still an alcoholic?
I'm sure she is. Okay. I haven't spoken to her in 3 or 4 years.
Okay. She was when you ended that relationship.
Yes. Okay. And not really showing any signs that that was ever going to change. So I forget where I was going.
That's okay. No, it's fine. We were talking about infidelity. Because I like to have that conversation. Right. And it's the first time I've really had an opportunity to discuss infidelity. And mm-hmm. so even though it wasn't you, well, you experienced it in a different way than, like, being either the cheater or the cheatee.
I will say that it has definitely had an influence on my relationships going forward. I would say there was one partner that I had very early on that I cheated on and lied to about. You guys can't see, but I use air quotes with that because so in high school, one of my first girlfriends, we had a relationship on and off for years. So from, like, most of middle school into early high school. And I had met a girl who was in my class, and we started fooling around seeing each other. And she came over one day, and I'm like, okay, I have to call and break it off with this other person before we can proceed with this, because I can't feel right doing that. And I realized, like, looking back at it, I did it in, like, a really shitty way. So, like, whether I was being like, I'm breaking up with you or not. Like, it was just shitty all around. Like, yeah. I did not handle it correctly. I did not handle it well. I always had, like, this skewed idea of what being faithful was. And, you know, it wasn't until later in life. We're young. We're stupid. We don't know shit about shit. And mm-hmm. So it's, you know, we make mistakes. We learn from them. And so it wasn't, you know, till much later in life, like, I understood, like, this is what it actually means, like, to be with somebody. And if you're not happy with being with somebody, how to respectfully end that. Just calling your partner up on the phone and saying, hey, I want to see this other girl, so I'm going to break up with you, is not how you do that.
I think it takes a lot of grace to do that, though. And I think at a young age that grace is not present. Mm. We don't have the life experience or the will necessarily. No. No. The realization and the will to, like, really make sure that we take care in all of our relationships, even with ending them. Yeah. I mean, as adults, a lot of us still don't have that will to take care of, like, you know, be careful, be kind to people when we're ending a relationship.
Right. So. Well, and usually the things that bring us to the end of a relationship mm-hmm. are hard things, right? Mm-hmm. It's hard to find that care and that, because things have become critical.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, and it's hard work. It mm-hmm. really is. So me and my partner, we have ended our romantic and sexual relationship, but we're still trying to salvage our friendship and maintain a caring, loving relationship with one another. Mm-hmm. And that is fucking hard. Mm-hmm. It's hard work to do that, because you have to take the other person's emotions and your actions and how that impacts them mm-hmm. into consideration all the time. Mm-hmm. Because you're coming out of this dynamic where there's all these fuzzy boundaries,
yeah.
And you're having to place boundaries there. They're having to place boundaries there.
Mm-hmm. And navigating the hurts.
Yeah.
Now that
you're going to hurt each other.
Yeah.
It happens. And coming back to that and saying, I'm sorry. And admitting that you did something wrong and apologizing for it mm-hmm. and meaning your apology.
Would you like to move on to another question?
Sure, let's move on.
Okay. So, why don't you tell me about your relationship to your body, its form and its function and its feel?
My relationship to my body is, I love and at the same time am starting to grieve my body. I would never say that I looked at myself in the mirror mm-hmm. and thought, wow, I have an amazing body. But it is my body. Mm-hmm. And I love my body for that. Like, I'm a relatively fit person. I've always had kind of a pudgy gut. Not like super beer belly or anything, just kind of a little bit of extra something that, mm-hmm. that sticks out. Yeah. I've never been a terribly muscular person, but I at the same time don't think that I need to be that in order to love my body. Like, it does for me what I need it to do. And as I'm getting older and as I am starting to notice that it is not able to do the things that I need it to do as well as it used to, mm-hmm. I'm starting to have much greater appreciation for my body. But that's also where the grieving comes in, mm-hmm. right? Because I'm getting to that point where I am recognizing my mortality mm-hmm. and that this thing that has carried me 37, almost 38 years around this earth is not always going to be there mm-hmm. and is starting to break down. You know, it's starting to show age, mm-hmm. which is, as a massage therapist, we have a tendency to have a much deeper connection to our body. We have to. Mm-hmm. And so kind of recognizing those signs as they start to pop up and become prevalent. Like, mm-hmm. I did a lot of fucking really bad shit to myself when I was younger, and I definitely took my body for granted. Mm-hmm. And I'm regretting some of that now. In terms of my sexual relationship with my body, I've really gone back and forth with it. So when I was 17, I really had what I thought was a very beautiful, almost feminine form. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was fucking hot.
Yeah.
My girlfriend had this dress from Hot Topic that was like very gothy and like, we called it a vampire dress, but it was, you know, like kind of that mid-century kind of Victorian almost. And goddamn, I looked amazing in that dress.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then several years later, I put that same dress back on and my body was totally different. Like the testosterone had done its job and like my shoulders broadened out and my chest broadened out. I've always kind of had titties a little bit, but I had lost a lot of that feminine form.
Yeah.
And honestly, I loved it. I loved having kind of this in-between masculine and feminine body. So there's some level of grieving around that too.
Yeah.
Right. And there's a want to have that I know that, you know, I'll never have that again.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with that, but it's definitely kind of sad for me.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think when, especially around gender, if there's something that you want that you can't quite actualize, it can be challenging for sure. That reminds me of, there's a podcast episode, it's On the Heart, which is linked on my website under resources, and it's probably like 8 or 9 episodes back now, but they feature a new podcast that they're launching in collaboration with a guy, an Italian man, and it's called Meat. And it's called Meat because it's about the human body, and he starts the whole podcast series with an episode about himself. And he's this Italian man who grew up and he was in ballet and he had a pretty feminine form growing up. And then he talks about basically as the testosterone starts coursing through his body changes. And he actually kind of engages in a conscious effort to make himself fat so that he can enjoy the softness of his body. And he then talks about the way that people receive him as a fat person and his contempt for the way that people treat him as a fat person in comparison to the way that he loves his body as a fat person.
Right.
And then his transformation as he's like trying to lose some weight and things like that. But it's like such a fucking beautiful episode. And it reminds me a lot of what you're talking about. And you know, and there's only so much that we can do in some ways to, I was listening to this really great talk. Okay. I'm changing gears a little bit, but it's related. I was listening to this really great talk, and I don't remember her name. I can try and find it. I attended the Explore More Summit webinar with Dawn Sarah, and it was all about body politics. And I wasn't able to watch everything because it was a really busy week that week, which sucked. But one of the last days, they had this woman on, and she talks so much about, she kept bringing up like health and things like that and healthism, but she talked about non-consensual, like things that the body does non-consensually, right? And I loved that concept. Like sometimes we non-consensually gain weight, sometimes we non-consensually lose weight.
Right.
Sometimes we non-consensually, you know, testosterone comes in and changes the way that, you know, our relationship to our body. There are a lot of non-consensual things that just biology doing biology's thing creates. I just liked the way that she spoke about that. And I think it definitely is another argument for more bodily autonomy, because there's so much that does non-consensually happen to us that we can't control.
Right. Well, and it creates an interesting dynamic of consent, right? When your body itself does things that you don't want it to do, that you don't, you haven't given it permission to do. It's just going to fucking do it anyway, because it's our vessel, and it's going to do what it does, and we are absolutely in zero control of that.
Yeah, we are at its mercy for sure.
Which again brings me to this wonderful appreciation for the body that I have, and that I have it now. As a massage therapist, I treat people who have a myriad of issues and a myriad of bodies, and some people's bodies don't do the things that we take for granted, and the grief that comes along with that. I have a couple of clients who have a condition called EDS, which is basically where your soft tissue breaks down. To suddenly find yourself not able to do everyday activities because you're going to tear a tendon. I had a client who, she tore her rotator cuff, and her doctor was like, well, it's because you mistreat your body. And it's like, it's not because you mistreat your body. It's because you have a body that is literally trying to cause you harm.
Yes.
And the grief that comes around that realization, like, I have a body that is trying to kill me. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, all of our bodies try to kill us in the end.
Yeah.
And so there's this level of appreciation for how amazing this thing is that we carry around with us, that we have the deepest, most intimate relationship with. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
That's okay.
And how out of control that we are with that.
Mm-hmm.
And how much we take that for granted, especially when we're healthy.
Mm-hmm.
To suddenly lose that and to realize this thing that you had, this wonderful thing that you had, and you lose it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what you're left with after that, and how you navigate existence. Because you're going to, bodies are incredibly hard to kill. Regardless what people will tell you, it is really, really hard to kill a human body.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody, really, outside of, you know, extreme conditions. And it will persist. It will keep trying, regardless how damaged it is. It will keep trying to continue on. It will keep trying to stay alive.
Mm-hmm.
And so for a lot of people, they're left with this thing that is not theirs.
You know?
This is not the body that I experienced the first half of my life in, or the first quarter of my life in. And suddenly I'm trapped in this thing. You're going along for the ride with it.
That's definitely something that we confront in surrogate partner therapy, because we work with people with disabilities who do experience sexual desires but have been desexualized. And that is something, that's something that's interesting, as most of us, a lot of us have the ability to fall back on its function. You know, like I have a fat body. Some days I have a hard time. I'm having a hard time with it right now, which is really annoying me because I'm doing all of this personal work. But I'm doing all this personal work on it, but it's also really challenging work, because the podcast that I did with Hunter, you know, I realized that I don't actually know what I think my body looks like and what my body actually looks like are not the same.
Right.
And I decided that, you know, yeah, I could live in ignorant bliss, but I don't like when I look at a picture and I'm like, berate my body, because I'm like, that's not what I look like. Like, I don't think I look like that. And I don't berate my body that bad, but I'm a big fan of realism and being grounded in reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like, that's work that I want to do. I want to know what my body actually looks like now, because I haven't always been in a fat body, and I want to radically accept what it is. And I'm about to teach a course on this in February on radical body acceptance. So I really want to be like, one, on top of my game, and two, I just want to do this for myself. So I am doing all of this work in like kind of forcing myself to look at my body, look at pictures of myself with my double chin, look at the kind of like lower pooch that I have, and like be like, this is your body. Look at the new stretch marks that I've just developed and be like, this is your body. And then once I become very aware of the reality of my body, then coming to accept it. So I'm obviously coming into a tricky part, because like those old habits are coming up of like loathing my body and things like that. So, but I always have, like, in this whole process, I always have this like ability to fall back on the fact that my body functions really well.
Mm-hmm.
I have an abnormally low heart rate. It's like the doctors get concerned when they look at my blood pressure and my heart rate, that they're kind of like, okay, like, is something wrong? and nothing's wrong. I'm totally like fine. I don't have joint problems. I can still run.
Mm-hmm.
I quickly get back. Like, I haven't been running for the past couple weeks. My body is able to get back into it really quickly.
Yeah.
Like, there's so much that I get to say, like, about its function. Like, okay, like right now I'm having a hard time with the way it looks as I'm like forcing myself through this process. But like the function is all there. Like, it's really pretty good, except for the fact that, like, now I can't lose weight and I used to be able to. Like, I think that's just me getting older. And also just really enjoying pleasure and food. And, like, I don't think I overeat, but I definitely don't do it. I definitely don't restrict myself
right.
in any way of, like I'm not like, oh, I'm going to stick to this.
Well, and you also have to look at, like, what have your habits been in the past? Because it's not necessarily what you're doing now. It's what you've done, mm-hmm. right? Because we forget that we've been carrying this thing around with us this whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And so those things that I've done in the past have a direct result now on where I'm at and what my body is doing and how it's functioning.
That's true.
And so sometimes we get stuck with these things because mm-hmm. of choices that we made in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to accept that. We have to... And acceptance is a weird thing because a lot of people think that acceptance means I'm giving up.
Yes, I know.
And that is not at all what acceptance means. What acceptance means is you are taking the reality of the situation mm-hmm. and you are finding a way to be okay with it in that moment. It doesn't mean that you have to stop trying
yes.
to change it. But you also have to figure out how you can be okay with whatever that situation is mm-hmm. in that moment.
Yeah.
That's really the core of what acceptance is.
Yeah.
Not just, I'm surrendering and fuck it, I can't do anything about it, and I quit.
Yeah.
Right? That's not acceptance. That's quitting.
Yeah. I agree. And there's a great book that I am... I think I'm getting it for Christmas, honestly. But it's called Radical Acceptance. And it's really about that concept. Because honestly, again, it's the idea that you need to be grounded in reality and accept what is, you know, in this case, like radical body acceptance and be like, this is the vessel that I live in.
Mm-hmm.
For you to move forward and do anything, to feel pleasure in that body, to enjoy food in that body, whatever that is. I mean, that is also linked to pleasure. But yeah, so I think that I always have that crutch, right? This kind of ableist crutch that I can be like, well, my body functions really well,
mm-hmm.
like, especially for a 35-year-old body. And some of my clients don't have that. And like, function might be the most sensitive part for them to discuss. Like for me, you know, in this ableist culture, I'm like, well, I've got that. But I'm going to have people that are going to come to me, or if I may, like, reference your partner, like, she doesn't get that option. She has a pretty adversarial relationship with her body, a non-consensual adversarial relationship Absolutely. With her body.
Absolutely.
And I have to be pretty sensitive to that because not everyone, you know, and it really pushes back on this. People want to defy mortality. And so they think if I lose weight, if we're looking at like fat politics,
right.
or if my doctor says that I obviously abuse my body, well, I can just like not abuse my body and stop it right there.
Right.
That's not like, that's such an insane idea.
Greening towards the edge of the cliff. Mm-hmm. there's nothing you can do about that. There's
yeah.
nothing you can do that is going to stop that.
Yeah.
I mean, there are things you can do to take care of yourself and make that journey a little bit more pleasant and mm-hmm. a little bit more pleasurable. But ultimately, nobody gets out of this place alive.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've definitely gone for about an hour.
Okay.
I'm thinking that maybe we can break this into two parts.
Okay.
So we are going to bid you guys adieu now and see you in the next week.